Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
This is VOA News. I'm Ann Ball reporting. More than 30 people have been killed Monday in fighting in eastern Ghouta outside Damascus, Syria, according to activists. Airstrikes and bombing resumed after a shaky start to a 30-day ceasefire across the country. It was passed unanimously by the UN Security Council. However, Russian President Vladimir Putin on Monday ordered a daily humanitarian pause. In Moscow's airstrikes and Syrian rebels in a five-hour window to let civilians escape from clashes near Damascus. Russian defense minister said starting Tuesday, the Russian stand-down would run from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. local time with the goal of avoiding civilian casualties. He said a humanitarian corridor is being created so civilians can leave the city. Russia has blocked a UN Security Council resolution that would have called out Iran for violating an arms embargo against Yemen's Houthi rebels. During a vote Monday, Russia wielded its veto against the British-drafted text. China and Kazakhstan abstained. The council instead unanimously adopted a Russian written resolution that called for a simple one-year extension of the sanctions against Yemen and a renewal of the work of the panel of experts. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced a cabinet shuffle that replaces the finance minister and puts a former finance minister in charge of the country's troubled state-owned companies. This is VOA News. Nigerian's President Muhammadu Buhari stated his resolve Monday to make sure the recently kidnapped girls from a school in Dapchi will be released, saying the government remains unrelenting towards rescuing all those abducted. He said he has directed all the security agencies to immediately ensure that every effort is directed to ensure the safety of the schools and the students, as well as bringing back the girls to their families. 110 girls are missing after an attack on a school in northeast Nigeria by suspected Boko Haram insurgents. The ongoing conflict in South Sudan is pushing millions more people in the country closer to famine, says a new report by the United Nations. This year, food insecurity in South Sudan could affect more than 7 million people, some 60% of the country's population, if they do not receive sustained assistance, says the United Nations. The joint report by three UN agencies says that currently almost half of the population has been at a crisis level of food insecurity since January. The head of the Food and Agriculture Organization representative for South Sudan says the worsening situation is mostly due to the expanding conflict. Parts of the South Sudan were declared famine areas in early 2017. The UN warns that famine-like conditions could return during the lean season, May to July, unless assistance and access are maintained. The UN Secretary General on Monday called the Rohingya Muslims one of the most discriminated against populations in the world. Antonio Guterres called for unfettered humanitarian access to Myanmar's Rakhine State, the area where the Rohingya Muslims fled after being abused and tortured. They are now living in Bangladesh. Here is Guterres.
Deprived of nationality, they have been subjected to extreme brutality by military forces and others, and cast out of their homes and country in a clear example of ethnic cleansing.
U.S. President Donald Trump vowed Monday to turn our grief into action to make schools safer in the aftermath of a mass shooter's rampage at a Florida high school that killed 17 people. I'm Ann Ball in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today's Tuesday, February 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Campaign rallies for Sierra Leone's March 7th elections are underway, and today is the opposition National Grand Coalition's turn.
We should expect an orderly parade by our supporters, membership, and sympathizers across the streets of Freetown to the National Stadium, where they will be addressed by the flag bearer of the National Grand Coalition.
Sulema Banjantijanse is the campaign manager for the National Grand Coalition of Sierra Leone. Both the United Nations and South Sudan's government say more than half of the country's population faces extreme hunger. Donors raised $510 million for a G5 Sahel force, and a curfew has been extended in Cameroon's Anglophone regions, but the secessionists say they will defy it.
The colonial governor has absolutely no authority to declare a state of emergency in the city of Bamenda. The Federal Republic of Ambazonia is a sovereign state with international boundaries.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. A former U.S. ambassador will share his thoughts on recent political developments in Zimbabwe, and the trial of an artist begins today, Tuesday, in Equatorial Guinea. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Campaign rallies for Sierra Leone's March 7th presidential election are underway, and today, Tuesday, is the gathering of supporters of the opposition National Grand Coalition, led by Kande Yomkela. Tomorrow, Wednesday, is the rally of the ruling All People's Congress Party. Ahead of today's rally, President Ernest Bai Koroma has criticized Grand Coalition standard-bearer Yomkela as unfit to be president of Sierra Leone. But National Grand Coalition campaign manager Sulema Banjantijanse says his candidate is more qualified than President Koroma was when Mr. Koroma first ran for president. Tijanse, it would be better for coalition candidate Yomkela to rule Sierra Leone than those, he said, helped to bankrupt Sierra Leone during the past 11 years.
Well, we should expect an orderly parade by our supporters, membership, and sympathizers across the streets of Freetown to the National Stadium, where they will be addressed by the flag bearer of the National Grand Coalition. From the east end of Freetown, the assembly point will be at the Opgonton table, and the assembly point from the west will be at the Lomley roundabout. They will proceed from there to the National Stadium.
So let's talk about the chances of your candidate, Mr. Kande Yomkela. What are your chances for your candidate come March 7th?
Well, by the grace of God, we hope to either win outrightly during the first round, or we hope to be in the second round with one of the other two parties.
I'm reading a statement made by President Ernest Bai Koroma about your candidate, Mr. Yomkela, saying that Mr. Yomkela is unfit to lead the country, describing Mr. Yomkela as a first-time voter, and that the job of the presidency is a serious one, and that Sierra Leoneans should not entrust that to your candidate.
I think that description is for himself, because Mr. Kande Yomkela is more qualified to lead Sierra Leone than he was in 2007. Mr. Yomkela's credentials for leadership are clear, clean, and illustrious. I think he's the best person to rule Sierra Leone than any of the other contenders running for the presidency. And as a matter of fact, it is better for Mr. Yomkela as a first-time voter to run Sierra Leone than for those people who are responsible for the bankruptcy of the nation to run this bankrupt nation that we now live in.
There is a court case against your candidate, Mr. Yomkela, the fact that someone has challenged him in the Supreme Court, saying that he's not a Sierra Leone citizen. When is the hearing, and how concerned are you the fact that this case has not been disposed of?
We are least concerned about it. I'm a lawyer by profession. I have been a lawyer for over 30 years, and I know that this case has no legs to stand on. It's standing on clay legs. There is no merit in the case. We are not even concerned about it. We are focused on campaigning and getting our message of change to each and every household across the country.
I know the political parties are in discussion with the police and the security agencies in terms of what is going to happen on election day, whether the police will allow, I don't know, whether it's parading of different parties or supporters. I know the police would like for you and the other political parties to sign some memorandum. Have you signed that memorandum in terms of what's going to happen on election day?
We have not signed that memorandum because we still have concerns. We have concerns about the behavioral pattern of the police, and we also have concerns about the vehicles that will be accredited to fly the streets of Freetown and other major cities on that day. Because we have past experience of the ruling government using those vehicles to transport pre-marked ballot papers to stock ballot boxes, among other things. And secondly, the behavioral pattern of the police arresting our supporters across the country and failing to arrest the perpetrators of violence who happens to be members of the ruling party is a cause for concern for us.
Sulema Banja-Tijanse is campaign manager for the opposition National Grand Coalition presidential candidate Kande Yomkela. You are speaking with me from the capital of Freetown. Both the United Nations and South Sudan's government say more than half of South Sudan's population faces extreme hunger. An official with UN World Food Programme says there are unprecedented levels of food insecurity in South Sudan. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The report by the World Food Programme, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, UNICEF, and the South Sudan National Bureau of Statistics comes a year after South Sudan had declared famine in two counties in the former Unity State, but by June, the UN said conditions had improved. The Integrated Food Security First Classification, or IPC, report notes millions of people have been displaced by 4 years of fighting, and as a result, many are unable to farm their land or maintain livestock. The report says more than 7 million people, or two-thirds of the population, could become severely food insecure this year without renewed international aid. Ross Smith, senior program officer with the WFP, says, which means people don't have enough to eat on a daily basis.
They are skipping meals. They are eating different foods. They're reducing the amount of food they take. They're reducing food for children. And as we know, children require many meals per day and a diverse and balanced diet, and this has a significant effect on their future growth and development.
UN officials say they fear 1.3 million children under the age of 5 will be at risk of acute malnutrition. Serge Tissot, the Food and Agriculture Organization country representative in South Sudan, says the Greater Equatorial Region, which was once the country's food basket, is the worst affected. Tissot says in 2014, the region was predicted to produce 560,000 metric tons of food, but last year it produced only 260,000 metric tons, mostly because of the ongoing conflict.
Globally, this IPC report shows a deterioration of the food security situation in South Sudan.
Isaiah Chol Arwai, chairperson of the South Sudan National Bureau of Statistics, is calling for parties to the conflict to stop fighting and aid groups to scale up their humanitarian work in South Sudan.
The National Bureau of Statistics and the government host institution acknowledges with concern the seriousness of the two IPC projection period for 2018 and urges all actors to scale up their efforts in the coming months in order to prevent further deterioration of food insecurity and malnutrition in the country.
Alan Nadeau, the UN humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, says 4 years of fighting and a collapsed economy remain the biggest factors behind the persistent food shortages in the country.
Immediate humanitarian actions are therefore needed to stop any potential catastrophe in the coming months. At the same time, the fighting ongoing in the country and the insecurity need to be stopped to reduce vulnerability so people can go back to their home and go back to the land, and they can start to plow the field.
He says the 2018 humanitarian response plan calls for $1.7 billion in funding to provide humanitarian assistance and protection to 6 million people across the country. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 27th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up 15 minutes past the hour. A governor in Cameroon's English-speaking region has extended a curfew there to combat threats from secessionists who have declared unilateral independence from the country's French-dominated government. The curfew was first imposed 2 weeks ago. The new curfew will run from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. and restricts the movement of vehicles, persons, and goods. But it does not apply to what the governor calls forces of law and order, as well as ambulances. Chris Anu is Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatist Movement. He says what he calls the colonial governor has no authority to declare a state of emergency in Bamenda. Instead, Anu says only the self-declared Federal Republic of Ambazonia has jurisdiction over the English-speaking regions.
The only threat against the people emerging in the Northwest is coming from the colonial governor and the regime that he represents. It is only the colonial government that has troops, soldiers, gendarmes, police in disguised outfits roaming the streets looking for people to shoot and kill as they have done in the recent past. And so our action is the colonial governor has absolutely no authority to declare a state of emergency in the city of Bamenda. The Federal Republic of Ambazonia is a sovereign state with international boundaries. Our people take instructions only from the interim government that oversees our territory right now.
Chris, the governor is appealing to the general public in the Northwest region to be more collaborative with what he called the forces of law and order, describing your activities as detrimental and describing people like you as misguided individuals who are taking the peace in the region for granted.
How can he say there is peace in the region again with thousands of well-armed military on the streets of the city all over the region? We are not misguided. The only person again terrorizing, bringing peacelessness into the region is the colonial government with the city in Yaounde. What we have done, our people are basically protecting themselves from the aggression that is being forced upon them by the regime in Yaounde, represented by the colonial governor. We don't have issues with anybody. If they will pull out their soldiers, their gendarmes, and their police from our streets, there will be peace. But we have to defend ourselves. Our people have to defend themselves. They are also defending their rights and their freedoms because we are not a colony.
I wanted to ask you, there's a story that I am looking at, and it just came off the wire, that Cameroonian soldiers invaded a local community in Nigeria's Cross River State. Do you know about this, and do you, the secessionist movement, have people in Cross River for which, if this is true, the Cameroonian military might have decided to go there?
We have thousands of refugees, as you know, in Cross River State in Nigeria. And again, the government of French Cameroon has been trying to infiltrate those camps to abduct and to kill refugees. What Nigeria is not doing, which I believe is a compromise, is that Nigeria is not telling Cameroon that, listen, there are international boundaries between you and us, so you don't have to cross into our territory. You cross into our territory, you are breaking international law. That is what we expect Nigeria to tell the government of Cameroon. Unfortunately, Nigeria has not, and it is not surprising to us, considering what happened in Nigeria with the abduction of our leader, including our president, Siseko Julius Ayoktare.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-declared Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. As Europe seeks to stop migrants and militants reaching its shores, European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said international donors have raised more than $500 million for a multinational military force in West Africa's Sahel region. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
The European Union's top diplomat says the $510 million amount pledged at the international conference has exceeded their expectations.
It goes beyond initial expectations, thanks to an enormous mobilization, not only of the European Union and its member states, but also of other international partners.
Evoking the desperation young people feel in the impoverished Sahel, Niger's president said many of the youth had just two options in life.
One is to die at sea rather than dying in front of their mother, like what was said by a young migrant. Or the other choice, to respond to the malicious and manipulative call of terrorist groups in direct connection with criminal activities, weapons trafficking, and drugs.
To give hope to the next generation, Luxembourg's prime minister insists on the need to help the Sahel countries.
I think we should never forget that Sahel is not that far away. And it's in our interest also that we avoid conflict situation. I was a few weeks ago with my Belgian colleague, also my Dutch colleague in Mali. And we should see that the situation is, for the moment, a very difficult situation.
For the African Union Commission president, it's crucial to remember that no international action, no matter how strong it is, can substitute the efforts of the countries of the region.
By organizing via the G5 a global vision to respond to the multidimensional challenges that this group's countries are faced with, we will have accomplished a useful work in the fight against terrorism. The political will and firm commitment of this region constitutes the walls of this fight.
And while the summit was a real success, it's important to plan ahead, said Niger's president.
Unfortunately, the resources announced cover costs only for the first year of operations of the G5 Sahel Joint Forces. It's not certain that confrontations between us and the terrorists end in a year.
The G5 Sahel group was set up by Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, and plans to coordinate with the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali and France's anti-insurgent operation Barkhane, whose troops were deployed in the region since intervening in 2013 to beat back an insurgency in northern Mali. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Zimbabwe has gone through political, social, and economic changes over the years, culminating in a power shift last year with Emmerson Mnangagwa as the new leader. Former U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe Charles Ray shares his thoughts on recent political developments in Zimbabwe with reporter Evan Zinica of VOA Zimbabwe service.
Ambassador Ray says all the time he lived in Zimbabwe, he saw a side of the country that has not been exposed to the greater world. He says there are many things to talk about in Zimbabwe than what people see on television and read in the newspapers.
Zimbabwe has the potential to be one of the premier countries on the African continent because of the education of its citizens, the fact that it's blessed with abundant resources, has a fairly well-developed infrastructure that needs some work. So, I don't know, I was a bit disappointed that things didn't go better.
Ambassador Ray used to interact with members of the Mugabe administration to discuss issues of governance, human rights, and at times threats to his life.
It was a mixed bag. There were many in Mugabe's party, ZANU-PF, that I knew and I got along with actually quite well. There were others who took the hardline approach and were, you might say, constantly nagging me. So it was both good and bad.
On sanctions imposed on some members of the ruling party, Ambassador Ray stresses that there are no restrictive measures that were targeted on Zimbabwe. He explains how the sanctions were supposed to work.
First of all, I mean, there are no sanctions against Zimbabwe except the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Rehabilitation Act, which prohibits the U.S. representatives at the international financial institutions from voting for new loans to Zimbabwe. The administrative sanctions are actually against a few companies and individuals, around 200 or so. I realize that, especially because some of the companies that are sanctioned are banks, this does have a negative impact on people. But one of the things I tried to do was make clear what the sanctions are in the first instance. Zimbabwe is not sanctioned. Certain Zimbabweans are subject to administrative sanctions.
Ambassador Ray came in after the 2008 elections, which MDC, led by the late Morgan Tsvangirai, had allegedly won, but had been denied the opportunity to run the government. He says the decision by MDC to agree to the offer of going into a coalition government was the best at that time for the country and for the people of Zimbabwe.
Well, I mean, it certainly offered the opportunity to change the political dynamics, to create a political system that was more inclusive. I don't think that it actually worked the way it could have. I mean, it did not create a more inclusive political environment, unfortunately. But I think the opposition or the MDC made the right choice to go into government. I think the odds were stacked against them, but they did relatively well in that role.
Asked whether the USA government played a role in the negotiations between ZANU-PF and MDC over the formation of the coalition government, he says he was not involved since this happened before his time, but found no reason why the U.S. government would involve itself in that process, as there were other players and interested parties who had more reason to do that. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service in Washington, D.C., I'm Evans Zeninga.
The trial of artist Nze Ramu Isono Imbali begins today, Tuesday, in Equatorial Guinea, where the cartoonist is being held on what rights activists say are dubious counterfeit charges. Ramu was arrested in September last year for passport reasons upon his return to Equatorial Guinea. Usually based abroad, the successful cartoonist is known for his criticism of the regime of President Teodoro Obiang Nguema. Tutu Alicante, founder of EG Justice, tells Ricky Stryak how this case shines light on broader freedom of speech issues in Equatorial Guinea.
This case is important for a couple of reasons. One, it shows how intolerant the government of Equatorial Guinea is towards anyone that dares to criticize them. And second of it, so it shows the lack of the judicial independence. It shows how there are no institutions, no state institutions in the judiciary or in the legislative branch to guarantee any of the basic rights of freedom that citizens should have in any country. If you follow Ramon's case, you see clearly that the judge's hands at all levels have been tied, you know, they're waiting for orders from what they say the superiority, which in Equatorial Guinea only means from the president.
Is it correct that the authorities are claiming he has been arrested because of counterfeit money, not because of his cartoon?
Yes, that is exactly, in fact, what the government have claimed. The authorities have claimed that he was found in possession of 1 million franc CFA, and that's why he is being arrested. But again, we know that that's incorrect. That's far from the truth.
Beyond the Ramon case, are there other artists, writers, journalists in jail in Equatorial Guinea? What is the situation in broad terms in the country in regards to freedom of expression?
Yeah, so typically they would arrest this artist, and Jamin is a hip-hop artist who was arrested most recently, and they would just lock them up for a week and then release them, right? Or they would just close the centers, you know, like what happened with the Casa de Cultura in Rebola, which they closed the center, or they just harass you, close your institution, etc. Right now, in addition to Ramon, however, there is a teacher, but this is a teacher who sent a WhatsApp message to a friend of his in Germany. He's in Equatorial Guinea. He sent this message, a voice message to a friend in Germany. The friend, unfortunately, shared it with other people in Equatorial Guinea, and immediately this teacher was arrested, and he's still in jail, right? In the message, he was criticizing the corruption that exists in Equatorial Guinea, basically saying, unless you have someone in a position of power, you are out of luck in Equatorial Guinea, you can't get a job, you can't, et cetera, et cetera. So just criticizing the nepotism and corruption that exists in Equatorial Guinea, just for that, you know, this young man has been in jail now since, I believe, November of last year. So not only Ramon's case right now, but this teacher's case is another one that, you know, we're hoping to shine a light on.
That was Tutu Alicante, founder of EG Justice. You're speaking to Ricky Stryer from the U.S. state of North Carolina. And that's it for this Tuesday, February 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Ethiopia is set to undergo a major political change following the unexpected resignation of Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn. The nation is now under a six-month state of emergency, as declared by the defense minister, but the U.S. State Department says it strongly disagrees with a call to declare a state of emergency. A discussion on Ethiopia.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.